Henry Morton Stanley, Through the Heart of Darkness. Last week we began by looking at the beginnings of the life of Henry Morton Stanley, and this is really part two of the greatest journalist of all time. There's a whole lot of other things you can say about him too, as you looked at in the presentation last week, and Stanley and Livingston, how he managed to fight on both sides of the American war between the states, how he was a soldier, a sailor, a newspaper man, a pioneer, an explorer, even became an author, speech maker, member of parliament, was even knighted by Queen Victoria. All very strange, because while he's a famous American, he actually was born in Wales, and his name when he was born was John Rowlands, not Henry Morton Stanley. And there's so many other surprises about him, that he came from the poorest of the poor, abandoned, no family, and yet ended up in great honour, even as a, with his wife being Lady Dorothy Stanley and him being Sir Henry Morton Stanley. Not bad, considering where he came from. So tonight, the second part of the incredible story of Henry Morton Stanley. Stanley saw Africa as a challenge and Livingston as his example and as his inspiration. And Stanley dedicated his life to serving Africa by developing Christianity and civilization throughout the vast unexplored continent. On the 18th of April, 1874, a year after David Livingstone had died, Henry Morton Stanley was one of the pallbearers for the funeral of Dr. David Livingstone at Westminster Abbey. It took about a year to bring his body back to his home country. Stanley was given a foremost position on the right. Shortly after that, the Daily Telegraph of London and the New York Herald united to fund an expedition to Central Africa under the leadership of Henry Stanley to complete the work left unfinished by the lamentable death of Dr. Livingstone. To solve, if possible, the remaining problems of the geography of Central Africa and to investigate and report upon the haunts of the slave traders. So on the 15th of August, 1874, Stanley and three volunteers set sail from England for Zanzibar. He sought the men who had served him on the Livingstone search expedition or who had served with Livingstone and ultimately selected 356 carriers and soldiers. Phenomenal, probably the largest caravan ever. On the 12th of November 1874, loaded with animals and supplies, they set sail for Bagamoyo, which is on the east coast of Africa. It's very close to where today Dar es Salaam is. Immediately had to deal with those of his men who began stealing and assaulting the local inhabitants. Not a good beginning. Then he found out that some had kidnapped women. He forced them to set them free, of course. He then faced down a mutiny, and then there were desertions. And when people desert, they didn't just desert, they stole things as they desert too. They passed through areas of severe famine, their guides deserted, new guides got them lost. January 1875 began with a series of severe hardships and catastrophes. Men died from the heat, from lack of food, from exhaustion. Local inhabitants were hostile, and they severely overcharged the expedition for food. As you can expect, the moment they see a big expedition, prices go up. Sickness plagued the men. In the first 2 months, 20 people died, 89 deserted. That is a third of his expedition lost. And they were only 2 months in. Then the Ituru natives attacked the expedition. In just one battle, the expedition lost 21 askaris. They were the soldiers, escorts. When Stanley reached Lake Victoria, he called on the volunteers to man the boat, the Lady Alice. At this moment, he was actually engaged to Alice Pike. And he wouldn't see her for 3 years. He wrote steadfastly to her all that time. And when he got back, he found she'd married someone else, which was pretty devastating. The men declared that they were cowards on the water, and thereafter Stanley dispensed with asking for volunteers and selected and ordered his men to get in the boats whether they wanted or not. Beginning on the 8th of March, 1875, Stanley explored Lake Victoria, establishing it at the largest lake in Africa, covering 26,000 square miles. Now, it was John Hanning Speke who had founded Lake Victoria, but he hadn't circumnavigated it. He hadn't mapped it. That was left for Stanley to do. Stanley sailed along and mapped its 2,000 miles of shoreline, recording every cove, river, and island connected with it. Now, this was important for many different reasons. And one reason was, it was still uncertain, is this the source of the Nile? And Speke had advocated that, but he hadn't proved it. And now it was for Stanley to prove that this was one of the main sources for the Nile, but it's not the only source for the Nile. Frequently faced savage people, often drunk, screaming the intention to kill him. His calm and confident demeanor frequently prevented conflict, even as they charged and danced and ran up and their spears pointed at him, and he acted as calm as anything. In April, he met with Mutesa, the Kabaka, or the king of Uganda, or the Bagandans. John Hanning Speke had written of Mutesa. Mutesa claimed to be a Muslim, having been converted to Islam by an Arab, Muli bin Salim. But Stanley determined to destroy his belief in Islam and teach the doctrines of Christ. So for 12 days, Stanley instructed the king from the Old and the New Testaments. And at the end, Mutesa announced that he would follow the Christian Sabbath to the Muslim Friday. He would instruct the Ten Commandments to be written on the board, where everyone could see and study them every day. And Mutesa loaned Stanley men and canoes to explore the western shores of Lake Victoria. So Stanley's getting a bit of a beginning in his evangelism. Colonel Linant de Belfont was sent out by General Charles Gordon, who was once Commandant General of the Castle here at the Cape. He was at that stage Governor of Sudan, and he was sent out to establish communications with Uganda. Stanley entrusted him with a letter for the Daily Telegraph appealing for missionaries to be sent to Uganda. De Belfont was murdered in Sudan, but Stanley's letters were discovered concealed in this man's boots. And when they eventually found their way to England, they were published by the Telegraph, and a huge fund was collected, and missionaries were actually sent out to Uganda, where Christianity began to flourish. And to this day, there are vastly more Anglicans or Episcopalians in Uganda in church every Sunday than on all the British Isles and North America combined. Later, Stanley was confronted by hundreds of well-armed warriors in war costume, and only the protection of Mutesa prevented a fight on this occasion. Later, as they discovered the half-decomposed bodies with axe wounds, Mutesa's escort of canoes suddenly deserted Stanley. They suddenly realized this is not a good place to be. Within days, the expedition came under sustained attack, and Stanley wrote of a scene of rampant wildness and hideous verbosity beyond description. The boat was surrounded by a forest of spears. Over 50 bows were bent nearly double with levelled arrows. Over 200, what he described as stalwart demons, contended as to who would deliver the first blow. Stanley had to fight his way out of this desperate situation with his Winchester repeater rifle and shotgun. Now, bear in mind, a Winchester repeater had 17 rounds in its tubular magazine. So that's a lot of firepower. As they sought to row to safety, war canoes pursued them, and with his elephant rifle, Stanley sank boat after boat of the pursuers, went straight through the boats and sank them. For over 76 hours, they were without food before finding refuge, and upon completion of the circumnavigation of Lake Victoria, they were welcomed back to base camp, only to discover that another of the Europeans had died. Many more of the expedition were suffering from dysentery. Not surprising, living on this lake. Attacks of fever reduced Stanley to a mere 108 pounds, that's about 54 kilograms in weight. As they attempted to progress further into the Congo, several of the canoes proved to be rotten and they just sank. In all the expedition, they lost 5 canoes, a case of ammunition, 1,200 pounds of grain and 5 guns. The treacherous Bombira attacked their party and killed a number of men, and Stanley launched a counterattack. Then Mutesa asked for Stanley's support in dealing with the rebellious Wavuma. By innovation and audacity, Stanley intimidated the Wavuma to surrender without any cause for bloodshed at all. He then persuaded Mutesa and his whole cohort to completely convert to Christianity. Mutesa gave him an army of 2,000 warriors to escort his expedition to Lake Edward. After this, Stanley marched to Lake Tanganyika and completed the circumnavigation of the lake in 51 days, proving it was the longest freshwater lake in the world. Stanley had now been in Africa for 2 years. He had accomplished 2 great geographical objects, exploring and mapping both Lake Victoria and Lake Tanganyika. Now, without returning home, without even returning to the coast to refit his expedition, he prepared for the most audacious expedition of all, the exploration of the Congo River. At this point, Stanley had already accomplished much. He could have returned home with honors. Mapped the whole of Lake Victoria, mapped the whole of Lake Edward. What more do you need to do? But the fascination of the unexplored Lualaba River drew him. Was the Lualaba part of the Congo? Was part of Niger? Was part of the Nile? Could only be one of those three rivers because it's so big. And they knew from the coastline those are the only three big rivers that could possibly be disgorging this water when it reaches the coast. Which is it? No explorer had dared to venture into this notorious cannibal country. Stanley was convinced that the fast-flowing broad Lualaba must empty into the sea. It could only be one of those three great rivers. Stanley was convinced that exploring the Lualaba River would be what Dr. Livingstone would have wanted him to do. Yet he didn't have a single canoe to supplement the Lady Alice, which was broken into sections and was assembled at each lake. He would have to supplement his expedition with a force strong enough to give him a fighting chance of succeeding. To do so, he'd have to deal with Hamid bin Mohammed, known as Tipu Tip, a notorious, evil slave trader. Tipu Tip was shrewd, unscrupulous, ruthless, and he was cruel. His slave raiders had killed many thousands. They had enslaved countless more. Tipu Tip and 700 of his men gave confidence to Stanley's expedition, who were threatening to mutiny rather than go down the dreaded Heart of Darkness River. And so on the 5th of November, 1876, Stanley marched out of Nyangwe at the head of an expedition of nearly 1,000. By the second day, they were hacking their way through dense jungle, which made every step painful, and after a week of marching, they'd covered only 40 miles or 64 kilometers. Now, to give you a feel of what they were dealing with, this is pictures of the places now, and this is thick rainforest, very, very high in the mountains near Lake Tanganyika, very dense, and this is where the term darkest Africa came from, because the trees were so dark, the forest was so dense, you couldn't see sunlight. You could be in the middle of it and you wouldn't see sunlight at all. The sunlight could never reach the canopy floor. That's how dense it was. It was so thick and dark. And they were walking through this kind of forest or jungle forest. And, you know, you've heard of the mountains of the moon and the mountains of the mist, and this is what we're talking about. With massive pythons and all the rest of it. Here's some of the sketches of walking in some of those canopies, and it's like walking through cathedrals in some cases. It's so magnificent, but in other cases, very terrifying. All the sights and sounds, and they could feel like thousands of eyes were looking down them from every kind of bird and reptile and snake and monkeys and who knows what else was there. This is what the Lady Alice was. It was in sections that you could carry, and then they could attach it together, and it was basically a dismantleable boat, and it got them all the way down. The terrain became more difficult as the dense jungle shut out every ray of sunshine. When it finally reached the Lualaba River, the Lady Alice was assembled. While Stanley and his crew went by river, Tipu Tip and the bulk of the expedition continued parallel by land. Every village seemed to be eerily empty. The inhabitants had apparently fled, but the rows of skulls lining the streets, the human bones littering the huts and yards, spoke eloquently of the depraved nature of the inhabitants. This is the Heart of Darkness, where cannibalism was normal at that time. Where the Ruki River empties into the Congo River, Stanley's path was blocked by war canoes filled with what he described as hostile savages, who poured spears and arrows into his people, and as Stanley fired back, they fled. Smallpox broke out amongst the expedition. Soon they had buried 12 of their number. When they discovered the cannibals had dug up the bodies and eaten them, they began practicing burial in the Congo River. When they came across 6 old broken abandoned canoes, they repaired these and used these to transport the sick and wounded. But rapids overturned one of these canoes, losing 4 precious Snider rifles, and you can't really afford to lose that at the beginning of an expedition. Despite difficulties in land and river, sickness and hostile attacks, the expedition pushed on. Tipu Tip and others were now pleading with Stanley, turn back before it's too late, but Stanley was determined. He was not going to turn back. At Binyan Najara, on the 18th of December, the expedition came under sustained attack. They constructed a barricade of logs and bush to beat off the savage attacks again and again. The yells of their attackers and the booming of the war horns, the crack of the rifles and the muskets, and the screams of the wounded created an unnerving and chaotic din. For 2 hours they fought desperately before their attackers fled. Poison arrows continued to drop into the camp throughout the night, and sleep seemed impossible, but even under those conditions, many of the exhausted men dozed on and off. The next morning, Stanley set out in the Lady Ellis to scout the area. He discovered a series of villages just a quarter of a mile down the river. He decided to capture the nearest village of his attackers. Seizing it, he fortified it, beat off several wild and determined attacks, and massive arrows flew into the village from the jungle. 800 men and war canoes attempted to rush them. After beating off both land and river attacks, Stanley determined to make a night attack and take their canoes. A night attack in those conditions is a very difficult and brave thing to do. But this would not only deprive the attackers of their mobility, but enable his expedition to all travel on the river. So that night, under cover of darkness, they cut loose 8 long canoes from one encampment. This meant swimming in crocodile-infested rivers in South Africa. And they got 26 canoes from another, and soon these canoes, some of these canoes were actually 50 feet long. By 5 o'clock in the morning, they were all safely back in camp with 38 liberated canoes. At sunrise, they could hear the cries of rage from the savages who had just been deprived of the most cherished possessions. Now they were ready to accept Stanley's offer of peace terms, negotiation from position of strength. Stanley returned 15 of their canoes, paid them what he considered a fair price for the ones he kept, and then he released all their prisoners. Not much they could do about that. However, at this point, Tippitip had had enough. He and his followers would go no further. They determined to return east. But he had also taken back all the sick and wounded, which was a relief for Stanley. Now Stanley had 23 canoes. He felt he could survive on his own. He didn't need the escorts of this unsavory character. He made a speech to inspire his expedition. Into whichever sea this great river empties, there shall we follow it. You have seen that I have served you, saved you a score of times, when everything looked dark and dismal for us. If I risk my life, if I risk your life, I risk mine as well. It may well be that we will meet 100 wild tribes who yet, for the sake of eating us, will rush to fight us. We have no wish to molest them. If they fight us, we must accept it as an evil, like disease, which we cannot help. If we fight, we will fight for our lives. We shall continue our journey so that we shall toil on and on by this great river and to the salt sea. Stanley then declared a 3-day holiday in honor of Christmas 1876 with feasting, dancing, and canoe races. Each of the captured canoes were given names like Livingston and Herald and Telegraph and Matessa. And then the entire expedition on the river rode forwards. And just to give you an idea of what the river's like, here's the Congo River, obviously today, not much different from then. But you can see, you could fight a tribe on this side and get past them, but they're just waiting on the other side by the time you get back to them. And so on and so forth. You can just see how this is actually very difficult and dangerous. You're not past your danger here because you've still got a long way to go, but you're going to come back past the same village or tribe maybe another kilometer later and so on. And just look at some of these parts. You can get lost in some parts of the Congo River because it's not always straight. Sometimes there's multiple tributaries and they might come back, some might be a dead-end street, and so on. And you can just imagine how easily you could get lost in some of these pools, as they call them. But it's a vast, vast river. The Congo is one of the greatest rivers in the world. Soon drums and war horns warned them of imminent attack. Eager young warriors with painted bodies, grotesquely adorned with skins of wild animals, screaming, "Meat, meat," as they massed for attack. Stanley wrote that it must have appeared that they were like a herd of ownerless cattle straying amongst the starving. He described attackers as the living embodiment of hatred. That's the way he saw it. In order to protect his people, Stanley now instructed his men to collect shields after every battle. And these were used to bulwark the canoes, making them look something like the galleys of ancient Vikings with shields on the sides. By this stage, all distinctions between pagazi, who were the carriers, and the askari, the soldiers, had vanished. Everyone had to paddle, everyone had to fight. Every man both rode and fought. Those that didn't have guns captured spears, threw them back at the next hostile tribe they attacked. At one point, the expedition was attacked from both sides of the river, simultaneously. The attackers were painted half white, half red with broad black stripes. One war canoe was 85 feet long. Pacing out, that's a long way. As they targeted the Lady Alice, and that's almost a football field length, Stanley had his men fire a volley into the attackers. As the survivors leapt overboard, this massive canoe was captured and incorporated into the expedition's transport. Amidst the pounding of the drums, the screaming of the attackers, the noise of battle, came an ominous roar of a waterfall ahead. Attacked from both sides, with an obviously high waterfall just ahead of them, they were facing a dilemma, drowning or being eaten by cannibals. This is what used to be called between Scylla and Charybdis, or between the devil and the deep blue sea. And this is what the falls looked like these days. Pretty serious. You can't go over this with a canoe. At least, not survive, if you did. Stanley determined to establish a beachhead and fight. They built a stockade on an island and fought until sunset and through the night. Stanley scouted ahead. He established this only the first of a series of cataracts. These seven cataracts were later called Stanley Falls. It took a month of hard fighting to carry their canoes and kit past each of these waterfalls, fighting off hostile attacks in the dense jungle. By a series of bold attacks and outflanking maneuvers, Stanley required of his men to sometimes be fighting 72 hours straight without respite. At one point, Stanley surprised the attackers by capturing their village and holding their chief hostage until peace terms had been established. Stanley described the Iron Age culture in the Congo at that time as baskets, fish nets, bundles of wooden spears with iron points, human skulls ornamented the village streets, and human ribs, thigh bones, and vertebrae lay scattered around the huts. At one point, they found themselves surrounded by a huge net and massive men with spears hunting them like game. Sometimes their path had sharp pointed traps designed to injure or cripple them. The prisoners they captured had the filed, sharpened teeth of cannibals, ugly tattoo marks on their foreheads. He learned that when these cannibals were unable to capture strangers, they ate their own old men and women. And there were piles of skulls in some villages, like this walls of them. These are some pictures taken later, when Stanley came back. They didn't have cameras in this expedition, but of some of the people on the Congo River, and giving you a bit of an idea what it was like in the 1880s. Some of the sketches of some of the places in the Congo, and some of the interesting headdress people would be wearing. And again, a photograph of some of the villages on the banks of the river, and the way how some would be painted with chalk. Attacks came thick and fast, and sometimes with such intensity and in such numbers that had they not been prepared, they would have been overwhelmed. Savage screams filled the jungle, and drums were seldom silent. Finally, after a torturous month, the seventh and last waterfall was bypassed. With the Congo River a mile wide, they relaunched their boats, which they had to physically carry around these cataracts. There was tremendous exhilaration amongst the expedition, as they felt the worst was behind them. But they soon were to learn that the worst was still ahead. Attacks increased in intensity. Poison arrows were shot at them at any time, day or night. They felt like hunted animals. Stanley rose to the occasion, clear-headed and calm in battle, confident that God was protecting him. He was destined to complete his mission of ending the slave trade in Africa. But now his men had become hardened by travel and conflict, and they'd been united into an effective fighting force and an efficient team. Anyone who wasn't would have been dead by now. After a long series of battles and skirmishes, they faced one of the most desperate battles on the 1st of February, 1877. Warned by great shouting and thunderous beating of drums, they came around a bend and close to where the Aruwima River joins the Congo River, a fleet of gigantic canoes, bigger than anything they'd ever seen before, blocked their path. He formed up his boats into battle line with the Lady Alice 50 yards ahead as they confronted 54 battle canoes. The largest canoe had 80 paddlers. As the monster canoe aimed straight for the Lady Alice, Stanley encouraged his men, "Be firm as I am. Wait until you see the first spear and then take good aim. Do not fire all at once. Keep aiming until you're sure of your man." As the monster canoe discharged a broadside of arrows, Stanley and his men opened fire. The enemy retreated out of range to reform for another attack. Stanley decided to preempt them by launching his own attack. In hot pursuit, Stanley's men forced the attackers' withdrawal into a rout. When the attackers made for shore, Stanley's men pursued them and chased them through that village into the jungle. At the village, they found a mesquite, a temple, where the large circular roof was supported by 33 tusks of ivory, erected over an idol 4 feet high and painted bright red. This was the focus of worship of the Basoko tribe. There were numerous skulls mounted in poles, a half-eaten human forearm, and ribs on the fire. By this point, the expedition had travelled 340 miles north since leaving Nangwe. The Battle of the Aruwima River mouth was their 28th battle in the Congo. 79 people of the expedition had died so far. I mean, how many soldiers have fought 28 battles in their entire lives? That's extremely rare. I know Colonel Jan Breitenbach was involved in, I think, 56 battles. That's exceptional, absolutely exceptional. What Henry Morton Stanley went through in the space of just a few years is beyond comparison. They were still in the middle of the continent, and the exploration of Congo was not even half to complete. They still had a very long way to go, but Stanley was determined to never turn back. Well, no point turning back now. He knows what's behind him. He kept up all the details in his journal, which he entered daily, writing, "I persist, trusting events to an all-gracious providence." Storms threatened the canoes with destruction. A chronic shortage of food threatened starvation. However, at this point, they found friendly natives in the region of Rubunga, who were willing to trade food for wire and beads, which they brought for that very purpose. Like the other tribes they encountered in the Congo, these people were elaborately tattooed. They had never seen a white man before, but they had in their possession four antique Portuguese muskets, which had been traded for slaves. This greatly disturbed Stanley, as it indicated he might well start encountering hostile tribes armed with muskets. Now, his expedition had 20 rifles and 20 muskets. That would be inadequate if confronted by a large number of hostiles armed with firearms. The next tribe down the river, the Urungi, were also friendly and willing to trade, so that the men of Stanley's expedition began to hope they were emerging from the heart of darkness, entering into the outskirts of civilization. However, shortly after this, a shot rang out from an Urungi canoe, and one of Stanley's men from Zanzibar fell dead from a ball fired from a musket. A few days later, on the 14th of February, the expedition was attacked by the most militant tribe on the Congo, the Bangala. The Bangala were the most brilliantly decorated warriors they'd ever encountered. Their war cries resounded as their canoes advanced towards Stanley's men. Holding cloth in one hand and a coil of brass wire in the other, Stanley offered trade and peace. He'd been told the Bangala liked to trade, but they actually liked fighting more. The battle continued throughout the afternoon. Stanley counted 63 war canoes opposing them, each with an average of 5 muskets. That was over 300 guns against 40. The Bangala were skillful and they were aggressive. However, after a 5-hour battle, the Bangala retreated. This was Stanley's 31st battle on the Congo River. Very few professional soldiers have ever fought as many battles in a lifetime as Stanley fought in just 4 months. Incredibly, though, Stanley was in the forefront of every battle, standing in the prow of the Lady Alice, and he came through every battle unscathed. 3 days later, they reached a lake which they called Stanley Pool. At this point, they had travelled 1,235 miles since leaving Nyangwe, which is basically entering the Congo. Ahead of them were still 32 more cataracts, like this one. You know, you don't want to go down that in your canoe, not if you want to come out alive on the other side. Many canoes were lost, injuries incurred as the boats were laboriously hauled overland past every cataract. At one point, Stanley fell 30 feet into a chasm, but miraculously escaped with only minor injuries. You can imagine what it's like steering it. You've got to know if it's just rapids you can manage or if you've just got to stop and carried along beside on the shore. Their largest canoe, the Crocodile, was swept over a waterfall with the loss of 7 men, including his adopted son, Kalulu. This cataract was then called Kalulu Falls. The cataracts and rapids were so numerous that the team developed a standard routine for transporting canoes and kit past them. A dangerous whirlpool was only narrowly escaped. When the Lady Alice survived going over a waterfall, somehow remained afloat. This was named the Lady Alice Rapids. From 16th of March to 21st April, the expedition travelled only 34 miles in 37 days. Not even a mile a day. At one point, local, until then friendly natives advanced to the camp with muskets, spears, poisoned arrows and war cries. Stanley asked them, "Why are you approaching in such an aggressive manner?" Their reply was, "They'd seen the white man writing in a book." They demanded that he destroy the book, because it's a bad omen. It meant that their goats would die. Now Stanley had filled his journal with invaluable geographical calculations and sketches and details on tribes and languages and villages encountered. He could not sacrifice the fruit of all their trials and explorations. Nevertheless, he is compelled to agree to burn the offending book. So he went into his tent, pulled out his well-worn edition of Shakespeare, which was a similar size, had the same cover as his journal, so the locals did not realize the switch. They left with a satisfaction when the book was burnt to ashes. He was sad to lose Shakespeare, but he could buy another one, but he couldn't replace his journal. By now their shoes were worn through, and Stanley remained the sole remaining European on the expedition, again maintaining his record that he'd be the only white survivor of every expedition he led. Frank Pocock was the last one to die. They were reduced to wearing makeshift sandals, ulcers, sores developed in the soles of their feet. This is actually Stanley's boots at the end of that expedition. And you sort of wonder, what is the problem with our bootmakers today? Because I've worn brand new boots, taken it onto the mountain, and found the whole thing falling apart on its first climb, gone back to the shop, and how would Stanley and Livingstone have managed to cross the continent with shoddy workmanship like this? And these are things that, you know, sold in good shops here, Cape Union Mark, their boots and things. Come on, guys, you can do better than this. But obviously, workmanship these days is not of the same standard. At another waterfall, a last remaining European companion of Stanley was lost. Trying to steer around a treacherous whirlpool, Frank Pocock, the sole surviving European member of Stanley's expedition, was lost. Most of the men of the expedition now fell into dark despair after this accident. After all the diseases and battles and struggles against nature and heat and exhaustion and strain, the men threatened mutiny. 31 attempted to desert, but local chiefs would not allow them to pass through their territory. Soon the mutineers had to return, and Stanley attempted to inspire his tired, hungry, and understandably discouraged men. In the next month, they travelled only 3 miles. 3 miles in a month. Another 3 cataracts remained ahead. Dense jungle. The tribes were sullen and uncooperative, unwilling to trade any food. All on the expedition were wasting away for lack of nourishment. Can't exactly eat beads and wire. They had trading items, but not food. There were only 116 people left on this expedition, which started out with 356. 40 were seriously ill, as they were apparently only a few miles from Boma, where there were apparently European settlers. Stanley sent messengers ahead requesting emergency food supplies. 2 days later, the messenger returned with pagazis bearing food and a message of welcome from the Europeans of Boma, who would have been either French or Belgian. This gave them the strength to walk the remaining 3 days. On the 9th of August, 1877, 999 days after their departure from Zanzibar, they were welcomed back to civilization before white men had treated them to a banquet in Boma, all the way from the Indian Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean, via Lake Tanganyika, Victoria, Lake Tanganyika, and the Congo River, Stanley Falls. Wow, what an expedition. From there they were transported to Cabinda, which is a Portuguese colony, is what it looks like many years later, not at that stage. And a ship carried them to Luanda, where they were boarded another ship, which brought them to Cape Town. Here in Cape Town, Stanley was welcomed and honored while a ship anchored in Table Bay, a British warship, then carried the explorers from Cape Town to Zanzibar. And so he was an honored guest here, including at the castle, and going from Cape Town, and he writes some of his impressions of this highly civilized outpost of Europe at the tail end of Africa. A picture taken at that time, notice photographs in Cape Town. And that's at the end of that expedition. Remarkable that he's at all even alive. Of the 359 people who left Bagamoyo with Stanley 3 years before, only 82 returned alive to Zanzibar with him. 58 had been killed in battles with cannibals in the Congo, 49 had died from smallpox, 9 had starved to death, 14 had drowned. Typhoid, fever, crocodiles and other causes accounted for the rest. Never before, nor since, has any African expedition accomplished so much. Stanley had surveyed the Great Lakes of Victoria and Tanganyika and the world's second largest river, the Congo. He had succeeded in exploring and mapping more territory than the explorations of Burton, Speke, Grant, Baker and even Livingstone combined. The political and commercial implications of the geographic discoveries were immense. Stanley was only 37 years old when he completed his expedition from coast to coast, from the Indian Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean, across the heart of Africa, and across the most difficult, dangerous, inhospitable part at that. And this gives you a bit of an idea, if you put the modern countries in, you went all the way across Tanzania and Uganda and the Congo, past Gabon and ended up in Angola. Of all the great explorers, Stanley alone followed up his explorations by developing an empire. He determined to pour the civilization of Europe into the barbarian of Africa, as he put it. Commerce would be used to bring Christianity and culture to the Congo. He described isolation as the great curse of Central Africa. Isolation had enabled the slave trade to flourish and all these other evils. European missionaries and businessmen were needed to open up the great continent to civilizations and free the Africans from animism, superstition, slavery, intertribal wars, and cannibalism. The 1,425,000 miles of the Congo River Basin were comparable to the Mississippi and the Amazon. Even today, our calculations are there's 18 million people living on the Congo River and its tributaries. The 3,000 miles of the Congo River poured 12 million cubic feet of water into the Atlantic Ocean every second. I don't know who calculated that, but that's impressive. It had a tremendous potential for hydroelectric power. In fact, you could power every home in Africa and every business in Africa now if you fully utilize the hydroelectric power capacity of the Congo River. It had tremendous potential. Africa could be freed by civilizing the Congo. Congo actually is one of the richest countries in Africa potentially in terms of mineral potential and hydroelectric potential. In January 1878, Stanley was welcomed to Europe by representatives of King Leopold II of the Belgians. King Umberto of Italy sent him an award. The Khedive of Egypt gave him a medal. All the geographic societies of Europe awarded Stanley gold medals. The Prince of Wales paid him tribute. Governments throughout Europe honored him. The Congress of the United States passed a unanimous vote of thanks for his achievements. Quite extraordinary considering he had deserted from both sides of the armies and, you know, should be shot in America in terms of their laws that day, but all that's forgiven is what he's achieved. Stanley was now the most famous African explorer alive. Just 4 months after his return, he submitted his manuscript for Through the Dark Continent, which in more than 1,000 pages catalogued his incredible journey, and we have it, the first edition, two thick books downstairs as part of our library, Through the Dark Continent. In November 1878, King Leopold of the Belgians personally requested Stanley to lead a venture to create a Congo Free State. Now, King Leopold II was hailed in his lifetime as the greatest humanitarian on earth. And it's interesting that today he is damned to hell as the worst, most evil colonial exploiter in history. I've been in Belgium a number of times and I've had Belgian young people saying to me about how evil their great-grandparents and so on were, and King Leopold and all the things they did in Africa. And I said, isn't this interesting? You, who live in a society where you legally kill babies through abortion by the hundreds of thousands a year, we've legalized pornography, prostitution, legalized euthanasia, where even your state-employed doctors can kill patients without the patients requesting it, or any family member requesting it. State doctors can just choose to kill patients through euthanasia, 1,000 a year, without the patient's request. You've got legalized euthanasia, abortion, pornography, prostitution, gambling, legalized blasphemy, and yet you feel so morally superior to people of other generations. Isn't that incredible? I said, do you know, it could be in the light of eternity, before the judgment throne of God, that God will find your generation much more evil than your great-grandparents' generation that you're condemning right now. Because they saw themselves as ending slavery, ending cannibalism, bringing civilization, Christianity, and culture to people. They saw themselves as lifting up other people. Whether you want to condemn it today or not, what would they say, more importantly, what will God say about your generation and the evils you're tolerating? No, but look at the horrible things they did in the Congo. I said, do you know your generation now, through the EU and the UN and the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, you're funding the worst dictators on earth who are doing far worse atrocities against their people than anything you can refer to of the previous century. Don't you think it's hypocrisy and spiritual blindness when we can condemn others so far away that we know nothing about except what an antichrist blasphemous media tells us today, who've got their own agenda? Isn't it intriguing how there can be people today who condemn a man who was hailed in his lifetime as the greatest humanitarian for freeing the most amount of people, bring so much civilization? Today he's damned as one of the most evil. I don't know if this statue's still up there, because the Belgians have been pulling down statues of King Leopold like there's no tomorrow. It's like a new industry, dismantling statues of him. In May 1879, Stanley arrived back at the mouth of the Congo River with less than 100 men, determined to bring civilization to millions of the most savage people on earth at that time, living in one of the most remote, inhospitable regions. And this is the very region that inspired the novel The Heart of Darkness, which Apocalypse Now was based upon. The debilitating furnace-like climate, the dense jungles, the treacherous rivers, the myriads of insects carrying fatal diseases did not dampen the enthusiasm and vision of Stanley. He was determined to bring civilization to the Congo. Steamships and all of that. Railways. For 5.5 years, Stanley labored to achieve all of this despite overwhelming frustrations. His efforts in the Congo earned him the name Bula Matari, or the Breaker of Rocks. I break a lot of rocks in order to build railways and civilization in this most inhospitable terrain. Stanley had a reputation amongst officers as a hard man. But his response was, one is not likely to be hard with persons who perform their duties. But it is difficult to be mild or amicable with people who are absolutely incapable or who will not listen to admonition without bristling with resentment. He was described as a man of iron, a man of courage, a man of dogged will, and a splendid leader. But while he was respectful of the customs, traditions, and beliefs of the Africans, he was considered very harsh to his fellow Europeans, which actually is similar to the criticism of Livingstone. The Africans loved Livingstone. Even today, he's one of the most respected names in the world. But no European could work with Livingstone. Every one of his co-workers deserted him in his second expedition when he had the dream team, including Dr. Kirk and Thomas Baines, who painted these. We've got some prints of Thomas Baines' portraits of Victoria Falls. And he had all these top people being sent to be part of the Zambezi expedition, many commissioned by Queen Victoria herself to join him. The dream team. They all deserted him. They all left him. Even his brother left him. They all bad-mouthed him. When Livingstone came back to England after the end of his second great missionary journey, no one met him, no one welcomed him, no one saw him off when he went on his third and last journey, because he was yesterday's hero. They didn't. By the time he got there, they weren't interested in his side of the story, they already heard everyone else's.
So was it Livingstone or Stanley?
I'm talking about Livingston now because that's both. So they both had a similar experience that while they were very respectful of the Africans, they were apparently more harsh for the European co-workers. But the point is, the European co-workers, well, in the case of Stanley, they all died. In the case of Livingston, they all gave up and left. So it's, they were very different people, but on this point, it's fairly similar. So isn't that interesting? As one friend said, one man said, Stanley has no real friends. He has many enemies, but he has no friends. However long you might know him, I doubt you'll ever become his friend. Stanley could not understand, and he had little use for those who held their duty more lightly than he did. To him, duty was everything. He didn't play cards, he didn't play games, his only recreation was reading. Stanley negotiated over 400 treaties with the once warlike tribes along the Congo River, and these became the foundations of the Congo Free State. I mean, think of the ability. Yes, he could fight, but he could make peace treaties. He could bring civilization to people who he had once fought, and who had once tried to kill and eat him, and he could bring peace between tribes that had been at war for generations. They're amazing. Peace, order, progress, industrious work followed in his wake. He established 5 stations stretching over 450 miles inland, launched a steamer and boat on Upper Congo above Stanley Pool, built roads between Viva and Isangila. Even the wild, warlike Bangala made treaties with Bula Matari. Through his perseverance, through his diplomacy, through his patience and understanding of the tribes of the Congo, he brought civilization to the tattooed and naked savages who'd lived in barbarous depravity and cannibalism for centuries. Europe could have done with someone like this back when the people of Europe were doing this. In fact, there were people like Boniface who went to the wild Saxons, and think of the different missionaries out to, like Patrick going to the Celts in Ireland, who were every bit as savage as the Congo people before the gospel came there. And you need tough people, and Stanley had both a missionary mind, and he was a soldier, and he was obviously an administrator, which is strange because who taught him any of this? He didn't get this at school. He must have learned on the road. Stanley was hailed worldwide as the emancipator, the liberator, who ended the rampant intertribal slavery of the Arab slave trade, which had plundered the Congo for centuries. By the time his 5 years in the Congo was complete, Stanley had built a line of garrison stations for 1,400 miles up the Congo, established peace between tribes that had been in constant warfare for generations. He had established a far-reaching political and commercial organization. He had built roads and railways and launched 2 steamers on upper Congo rivers, 3 on the lower Congo, bringing peace and commerce and law to a land that had been wild and lawless for generations. Stanley negotiated 400 treaties with these once warlike tribes. Here's some of Hoke's picture taken in 1901. Those look some pretty serious spears. You would not want to be fighting these folks. By force of his personality in just 5 years, there he had brought all kinds of peace. Absolutely amazing. And here you can see some of, like, one of the steamboats on the rivers. Of course, there had to be ways of communication between each of the areas of the rivers. No boat can go the whole way down the Congo because of all those cataracts, waterfalls. So they had to have railways, waterways, railways, waterways, and so on. Once the most lawless, wild heart of darkness on planet Earth. And here you can see Leopold, the beginning of Leopold, which became the capital, now it's known as Kinshasa. He named it after, of course, King Leopold, who was the sponsor of the Congo Free State. The government of Belgium was not willing to put any money into the Congo. King Leopold bankrupted himself, put his entire fortune into building up the Congo into Free State, to end slavery there, even though today he is demonized as exploiting the people of the Congo. That's not the way his generation saw it. That's the way the 20th century retrospectively has judged him backwards. So there was Stanley now being hailed worldwide as the emancipator who ended the rampant intertribal slavery, Arab slave trade, which had plundered the Congo for centuries. Newspaper articles, books were written on this most remarkable man. Matthew 10, verse 28 says, "And do not fear those who can kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather fear God, who can destroy both body and soul in hell forever." Missionaries and traders were venturing up the river, establishing trading posts and mission stations where no one would have ever thought it possible just a few short years before. Not even David Livingstone could venture into the Congo before. Now, people like C.T. Studd could go and build mission stations in the Congo. And here's the Congo for Jesus rally being organized, and you can see these folks on Europe, but this is the vision. They're all planning to get to the Congo. And Congo is no longer seen as a place that you want to avoid. It's a place where missionaries went, and many missionaries went to the Congo. And schools were opened, and Sunday schools were being established, and order being brought, neat schools. Now, Stanley's choice of a successor was General Charles Gordon, who was en route to take over Stanley when the Mahdi's rebellion in the Congo forced him to change his plans. Now, remember, General Charles Gordon had been governor of Sudan, had ended slavery in Sudan, and then when he had succeeded there, he came to the Cape. He was governor general of the Cape, but the Cape didn't like him because, as Cecil Rhodes said of General Charles Gordon, he's a most unusual man. He has no interest in money. In fact, he had literally turned down a room full of gold by the Emperor of China for having saved his empire and ended the rebellion there, the Taiping Rebellion. And he turned it down and said, I have my army pay. I don't need any further rewards. Thank you. And so he literally turned down a room full of gold. When the Khedive of Egypt had offered him £10,000 a year for being governor, he said, I'll take £2,000. I don't need any more. And who would turn down 80% of his salary? And then he comes to the Cape, and Cecil Rhodes couldn't buy this Commandant General. I mean, he could buy everyone else. Everyone had a price, but not Charles Gordon. And Charles Gordon was such a pain in the neck, he took the Boer side in the Anglo-Boer War, the first Anglo-Boer War, 1880 to 1881. He took the Zulu side in the Anglo-Zulu War. He said, the British picked both fights. We drew first blood. We're in the wrong. We're the aggressors. They're in the right. And the people of Cape Town couldn't handle a Commandant General like that, so Gordon had to go. And Gordon also treated King Cetshwayo as an honored guest instead of throwing him in the dungeon of the castle, which is what he's meant to do, and shared the gospel with him, had Bible studies, prayed to them. So this evangelical general had to go, and he's kicked out the army effectively, or he's without any commission for 14 months. So he went to Palestine, which was then under the Ottoman Turks, and he spent a year in Bible study and archaeological excavations. And today, if you go to Jerusalem, they'll take you to Gordon's Calvary and Gordon's tomb. It's not Gordon's Calvary, Gordon's tomb. It's Gordon discovered the place which Protestants go to today and recognize this is the Calvary where Christ was crucified. This is the tomb where his body was laid. Because the Catholics and the Orthodox did not Bible studies or archaeological research. They went where some mystic monk had a vision and said this is the place, and they built some ornate temples over it and wrecked the place with all kinds of icons and so on. And so the Protestants have got these untouched places, and it's General Charles Gordon who identified them. And that's just because he's kicked out of Cape Town. And then he is on his way to take over from Henry Morton Stanley in the Congo when the British government redirected him. You've got to go back to Sudan. Sudan's in rebellion. The Mahdi's gone berserk. They're killing people all over the place. Slaves coming back to Sudan. But they wouldn't give him an army. He was just a token. They sent Charles Gordon and one aide-de-camp, one poor Colonel Stewart, and General Gordon sent there. What could two British soldiers do? But anyway, they could die. That's about all they could do there. And that's where he died. And so, unfortunately, General Gordon, duty called him to Khartoum at the very moment that Stanley needed him to take over and take his work further in the Congo. General Charles Gordon, Livingstone, and Stanley had a few things in common. Quite a few things in common, such as disdain for worldly money and for power politics, and they were people of principle. And so he had a date of destiny in Khartoum. Stanley regretted that many of his ideals, many of the principles of David Livingstone, which he had sought to honor, were betrayed by men who followed him. The people who followed him were the kind of bureaucrats often that just wreck things. Every country has these cursed political bureaucrats who don't care about the people, who just either about power or about bureaucracy or regulations or wrong queue, wrong form, we closed, come back tomorrow, whatever. We've all dealt with them. we've met these Dr. No people. So the Belgian Congo did not go as well after Stanley left it. In 1910, King Leopold persuaded the Belgian government to finally take over responsibility for administering the Congo. The Congo up till then was not a colony. Up till then, it was the Congo Free State. Interesting, Congo's gone back to the original flag that Leopold gave him. The star in the middle of a blue flag. After many other flags in between. Interesting, they've gone back to the Congo Free State flag. Incredibly, that was not the end of the African adventures of Henry Morton Stanley. He later crossed Africa from the Atlantic to the Indian Ocean to rescue one of General Gordon's governors, Emin Pasha. Emin Pasha was a deputy of General Charles Gordon. He was running Equatoria, and when Khartoum fell, where was Emin Pasha to go? He was a prisoner. The Mahdi's force were coming south, and all this drama. So that epic endurance started with an expedition of 708 men, another record breaker. Ended with 196. 512 men died en route. The afflictions, the diseases, the battles endured on the Emin Pasha rescue compared with Stanley's exploration of the Congo. But he succeeded in his mission. He got to Emin Pasha. He rescued him from Equatoria in Sudan from imminent overthrow and disaster at the hands of the Mahdi's Muslim forces. And Stanley and his men were welcomed to German East Africa in Bagamoyo by the guns of the German warships in harbour, which boomed out a salute to this epic explorer. He then wrote In Darkest Africa. We've also got a first edition of that. In fact, a lot of the sketches that are in this presentation come from these books of Henry Morton Stanley. In Darkest Africa is only 903 pages long. And here's how the Telegraph announced it, and copies of the covers of his books. Beautiful the way how they made these books and the indentations and the really superior printing qualities. And this is the map which I took out of the first edition that we've got here in order to scan. The Emin Pasha relief expedition, absolutely incredible. Now Stanley noted in this expedition, one of the most encouraging aspects of his Trans-Africa expedition was visiting the mission station of Reverend Alexander Mackay in Usambiro in Uganda. Mackay had been in Africa for 12 years in response to Stanley's urgent plea, that letter that was found in the boot and ended up in England getting published by the Telegraph, pleading for missionaries to come and follow up the conversion of Kabaka Mutesa. Stanley described Mackay as the best missionary since Livingstone. High praise coming from him. And he was called the Great Wizard of the Great Lake. And he did all sorts of amazing things, including pumps and boreholes and all sorts of things that just people were amazed what he could do. And the story of the life of Alexander Mackay, he lived 12 years, which was record-breaking in the field. And he died at age 42 or so. Alexander Mackay was one of eight missionaries within a few months of departing. Several of the missionaries with him had died. Three had died or been killed. Within a year, all of the others had died or been murdered, and he was the only one of eight missionaries who survived of the Church Missionary Society team to Uganda. But he succeeded, and today Uganda is one of the most Anglican, Episcopalian, Christian countries in Africa. And there are many people in Britain and America who are seeking to be under African bishops, either in Uganda, Kenya, or Nigeria, because they're staying true to the gospel and not accepting the LGBT gender confusion nonsense of the characters that they've got as bishops in the north. Stanley observed that the virtues of civilization never seem so clear as when he is in the jungle, and the wilds of Africa never seem so pleasant as when he's in the midst of civilization. I think many of our missionaries feel that too. When we're in the field, we really appreciate home. When we're home, we really long for the field. It's like everything is appreciated more in many ways, because I think you take things for granted unless you lose it. When you lose those privileges, then you really appreciate them more. And there's privileges in the field, just as in a spiritual sense, as there's privileges of comfort and convenience in civilization. Stanley met with England's Prime Minister, William Gladstone. He was a manipulative character if there ever was one. He's the one who shipped off poor General Charles Gordon to his death in Khartoum without providing him any support, any soldiers, any practical support at all. And Stanley urged Gladstone to build a railroad from Mombasa to the East African coast to the shores of Lake Victoria to help suppress the slave trade. And it's that railway line that the Lions of Tsavo held up for 4 months, terrorizing the lion, the man-eaters of Tsavo. You might have read of the Lions of Tsavo. That's another story entirely. Now at age 49, less than 3 months after his return to England from this last great African expedition, finally, he marries the talented, beautiful Dorothy Tennant at Westminster Abbey. She's a famous classical Victorian artist, and Westminster Abbey, which is the same Westminster Abbey where the Queen had a funeral, where David Livingstone's buried, where, for example, William and Kate were married. 12th of July, 1819. Now, Dorothy Tennant was a descendant of Oliver Cromwell. And here is the Westminster Abbey wedding, which was a major event. I mean, think of this. This is a poverty-stricken, illegitimate child from the workhouse, abandoned by everybody in Wales, beaten, abused, and now he's elevated to a wedding in Westminster Abbey, where kings and queens are crowned and married. Stanley received honorary degrees from Edinburgh, Halle, Durham, Oxford, Cambridge. He conducted lecture tours in the United States, Australia, New Zealand, and Tasmania. In 1895, he was elected a member of Parliament for North Lambeth, London. That's where Lambeth Palace is, you know, Canterbury and all that. But he was a man of action, not a politician. He accomplished far more by his writings than by his speeches in Parliament. His book, Slavery and the Slave Trade in Africa, was effective in mobilizing political will and action necessary to finally crush the last remnants of the vile trade in Africa. Stanley did more than any other human being since William Wilberforce to end slavery. In his autobiography, he wrote, "To those to whom I venture to consign the secret hopes and interests of my heart invariably betrayed me. I learned by experience that there was no love for me, born, so to say, fatherless, spurned and disowned by my mother, beaten almost to death by my teacher and guardian. Fed on the bread of bitterness, how was I to believe in love? But I was not sent into the world to be happy, but to search for happiness. I was sent for a special work." And he certainly experienced lots of cruelty and betrayal, but he was used by God to achieve great things. In 1897, he paid his last visit to Africa to take part in the ceremonies opening up the Bulawayo Railway Station in southern Rhodesia. His last book was Through South Africa, published in 1898. And so here he is at the Bulawayo Railway Station looking out the carriage window. Still in the lifetime of Cecil John Rhodes, and this was the beginning of the Cape to Cairo Railway Expedition. Just a few short years off the pioneer column had crossed the Limpopo River and raised the British South Africa Company flag over Fort Salisbury and here at Fort Victoria. And in 1904, they built the bridge over Victoria Falls. And this bridge, every piece of that bridge was made in England, I think all in Manchester, and shipped up, brought up by ox carts in some cases. And they were assembled, and they were told what time in the morning to put the last piece in the middle, because as the sun rose, everything would swell and then fit perfectly. And it did, and everything fit. That's engineering. 1904. No laser, this, that, and the others, GPSs and whatever it is, but they got it right. I mean, isn't it? And it's still carrying trains, pentechnicons, over the bridge. In 1899, at the age of 58, Stanley was knighted by Queen Victoria. You know, Britain was so class conscious. Incredible that someone from the lowest of the lowest of the low, like Stanley, or Mary Slessor, or David Livingstone, could rise to the heights, even the British Empire. If it's hard these days, it was harder then. Much harder then. It was a much more class conscious society then. To think that even Stanley and Mary Slessor, David Livingstone, could rise to the level of being honoured and received by the Queen. He died the 10th of May 1904 at 63 years old. He is the most famous convert of Dr. David Livingstone, one of the greatest explorers of all time, one of the most effective campaigners against the slave trade. He achieved more to uplift people's lives, save lives, extend people's life expectancies, bring civilization to the heart of Africa than any other. His 1874 to 1877 Trans-Africa exploit was the most outstanding achievement in all the history of the exploration of Africa. His tombstone, which his wife designed, got this granite brought in specifically, and all that's written on it, aside from dates and Bulamatari, is Africa. And at this, the church grounds in which this graveyard stands, they have got a memorial on the wall to the glorious memory of Henry Morton Stanley for setting the captives free and what he did to fight slavery. And really amazing, considering how much he is maligned today. 2 Timothy 1 verse 7 really applies to Stanley. For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. To have kept his mind through the insanity of the American war between the states, and so much that he suffered, and through the heart of darkness, and so many diseases and battles. He obviously was a man who knew how to fear God and not to fear man. So Denbigh erected the statue in the center of Denbigh. I mean, most people haven't heard of Denbigh, unless you've heard of Stanley. It's obviously the most famous son of Denbigh ever. And it's depicting him with his hat off, putting out his hand to greet Dr. Livingstone, I presume, right outside this church. However, and St. Asaph's workhouse has even put up a memorial to him. And he's remembered in the very valley where nobody wanted to care for him or own him, now in an honored way. However, just recently, some so-called poet decided to dismantle the statue to Henry Morton Stanley in Denbigh, and Denbigh has not re-erected Stanley's statue as far as we know. Who else has ever been born in Denbigh that the world knows about? And the most famous son of Denbigh, why would they take him down? You may find it intriguing to know in 2020, Congo, DRC, re-established the statue of Stanley, which had been taken down by Mobutu Sese Seko 45 years ago. So Stanley's monument might be taken down in Britain, but it's just been put back up in the Congo. That sort of tells you something. An extraordinary man indeed, and we've given different presentations on him over the years. His books, Kumasi and Magdala, How I Found Livingstone in Central Africa, we have got that here. Through the Dark Continent, In Darkest Africa, we have all these books here, absolutely treasures. I don't have this one, I'd like to get it, Into the Dark Continent, and Henry Morton Stanley, the African Explorer, these are other books to search for, Explorations and Adventures of Henry Morton Stanley, but this is a different sort of edition of In Darkest Africa. This is, would not be the original, this would be recovered from some where the original covers had broken off. This is how the original covers looked like, where they had all these engravings on it of hard covers. Then you get these less inspiring modern versions where they have the same text, but they don't have the same pictures, sketches, fold-up maps, and so on. The British expedition to Abyssinia is supplementary material from another captain is there. We've got both the modern and the original How I Found Livingstone in Central Africa. And then there's other books that have been made for children. And I'd love to get hold of this classic comic, but there was a time when, before Marvel Comics lowered the standard, you used to have classics produced in comic format. And wouldn't it be great to be getting comics of this standard today? It would be nice if Elon Musk bought out Marvel and had them to start bringing out some decent things. And even Livingstone's books, we've got them in different formats. This book's right here in the shelf. Stanley, the Making of an African Explorer, Stanley's Africa, Into Africa. This is a bit of a revisionist modern version, but it's good to know what they're saying as well. And Mr. Stanley, I presume. I helped produce a book on David Livingstone as a school textbook for Christian Liberty books, maybe 20 years ago. And in our The Greatest Century of Missions, of course, Livingstone is one of the 19 biographies. There are other presentations of his autobiographies. These are the modern ones. This is an interesting one on Sir Henry Morton Stanley Confederate, on his Confederate origins, and An Adventurer Explored. In 1939, Spencer Tracy and Cedric Hardwick played Stanley and Livingston in this film. It's a respectful film, but it's so inaccurate. It's just, oh my. They just missed so much of it. And it's obviously made in Hollywood, and they had an African film crew, so you see them walking across the felt with real animals, but at such a distance you can't tell it's doubtless somebody else. But everything else is on some sound stage. But they just miss most everything, and then throw in some American tracker who's wandering around there adding a bit of humour, but he wasn't there. Anyway, this is a more modern film. This came out in 1997. Nigel Hawthorne playing Livingston, Adrian Quinn, Forbidden Territory. It's quite good in quite a few ways, but there's things that frustrate one, such as that Stanley is smoking the whole time, and he never smoked. And they have him drinking, but he never drank. He is a lifelong teetotaler. He only drank once in his life, greatly regretted it. He is a lifelong teetotaler. And Livingston was a total teetotaler, and had him bring out a bottle of champagne at Ujiji upon meeting him, and Stanley and Livingston swilling champagne. That didn't happen. Those two men were completely anti-alcohol, complete teetotalers. They were the Temperance Society's Exhibit A. So why would they put things like that in? And then they also throw in his fiancée, Alice Pike. They throw her in here during this expedition, although he got engaged to her for the next expedition. She would have been about 12 if he'd got engaged to her here. This was not the right time, so they just threw that in from the wrong era. So it's a mismatch of all sorts of things. Still, it's a well-meaning, generally respectful film. It's just as they get the facts wrong. You wonder, could they not get someone who's actually read the book to guide them when they produce the screenplay? But that's about all, and this was done by National Geographic, who obviously history is not their strength. Still, those are just some of the resources that one can get. Back in 2013, I launched the Livingston 200 as we approached the 200th anniversary of David Livingston's birth, and we went through 12 countries that Livingston ministered through, but we cheated, we drove, and we culminated it with the Livingston 200 at Victoria Falls on the Zambian side, Livingston 200 Missions Conference, a big event, and on the 16th of November, which was the anniversary of Livingston founding, sighting, naming, mapping, measuring Victoria Falls, we had a memorial service at the falls with national TV and the mayor's office and local TV and Christian TV and radio all covering it. It was a really major event for Zambia, and it was a privilege to be there. And we had people as far as Nigeria who had come in to be part of it. So we set up the Livingston 200 website, where you can still get access to all of Livingston's museums, websites, pics, articles, books, online. And we set up the Dr. David Livingston Facebook page. And Livingston Fellowship is one of our websites. Also, we have got a Facebook page and a website, Henry Morton Stanley School of Christian Journalism. So those are some of our efforts to try and remember this great man. Any questions, comments, anecdotes, criticisms, complaints? Part two. Can you imagine if they could make a film on people like this? They make films on gangsters. Why can't they make films on great people like this? Livingston and Stanley deserve a lot of great epic films made on them. I mean, how can you compare the garbage that they put in these Marvel comics and these superheroes? You know, this is the thing. The comics used to focus on real heroes, like Henry Morton Stanley. Now they've got these ridiculous, unbelievable, impossible, breaking all laws of gravity and everything else. And they're fakes. Right? In the Bible, you've got real heroes like King David. And in history, you've got real heroes like Henry Morton Stanley and Livingston. Who needs these Captain Americas and Spider-Mans and so on? I mean, they're not real. I grew up with real heroes in my mind, you know, Oliver Cromwell and Stanley and Frederick Salew and things like that. And kids today, all the heroes are fakes. I mean, they don't only fake news, they're fake heroes too. And you can pray all you like to Spider-Man, he's not going to save you. Don't have something against Spider-Man in particular, I just think the whole Marvel comic enterprise is a lot of garbage. I just can't even begin to get interested in it. And yet they've got a whole generation that's got excited about nothing but fake. But what they're doing is it's like giving people fake food and they miss out on real food. They don't know what real food tastes like. If a person's ever tasted real bread, this artificial stuff they give you in the shops isn't quite as exciting out there, is it? Questions, comments?
How does he communicate with the locals in Congo?
Stanley was also a very gifted linguist. I don't know if he's as gifted as William Carey and David Livingstone, but he was gifted. He picked up a number of languages, and he was able to communicate in Swahili, for example, a lot in his first expedition across Africa. He picked up a lot. Now, he did have translators. He used translators. It doesn't seem that Livingstone used translators much, if at all. I can see no evidence that David Livingstone ever preached through interpreter. He might have sometimes communicated with a new tribe, but he very quickly acquired their languages. So Livingstone was extremely remarkable. But Stanley, he got to know enough of their language to even though he would use translators to communicate, he began to acquire and understand amazing amounts of them. And there was quite a bit of overlap, you know, just like Portuguese and Spanish has an overlap, and Zulu and Xhosa overlap. So you often have neighboring tribes, there's some commonality. And so, and Swahili is very much built on that, with a mix between Arabic and some of the coastal languages. And it wasn't just used throughout East Africa, but Swahili actually spills over in the Congo too. I'm surprised that the amount of people, especially in eastern Congo, can speak Swahili. So he did master Swahili, for example. Yeah, communication, big problem. But you've got to be good at communication, and that's how he negotiated 400 treaties in the Congo. That's a remarkable thing. You know, to be able to fight is incredible, that much. But to be able to make peace, normally it's a different person who's got to do that. To think he could be both a warrior and a peacemaker. Congo was so violent and then became so peaceful. It's just so remarkable. When he went back to the Congo, it was peace everywhere. It's like the people who'd fought him before, they weren't interested in fighting him the next time, because he came back with probably better equipped too. Well, that was the Bugandans. The Bugandans were far more civilized, very, very much more advanced. Buganda was a very advanced, civilized, educated people. They'd had more contact from the outside, missionaries, schools. So yes, by this Mutesa, the Kabaka Mutesa, saying he'd put up a board that people could read. Well, at that stage, only a small percentage of the population could read. But it was a nice token. But of course, once the missionaries came in, like Alexander Mackay, then real literacy became more common. Before Stanley's work in the Congo, there was no literacy. There was no written languages. And missionaries like C.T. Studd wrote the first alphabet, produced the first written books in those languages, which was the Bible. In most countries in the world, the first written, not even printed, but the first written example of the language came from the missionaries, and the first example was the Bible. And that's still true. That's also true for the Russians and the Ukrainians, by the way. They didn't have any literacy before the Cyrillic alphabet. The Cyrillic alphabet was produced by the missionaries. There were missionary brothers, one of which was called Cyril, after which you get the Cyrillic script. And so the very script that the atheists Stalin and Khan and Lenin were using was produced by missionaries for evangelizing the Russian and Ukrainian people. History upsets a lot of modern narratives. All these modern narratives that have gotten the universities will fall to pieces when they start to meet real facts up front. And that's why these arrogant Belgian kids that I was meeting were damning to hell the previous generation was a Belgian thing. You think you're so morally superior to the people who brought civilization to Africa, and you don't seem to see the problem that you're living in a society that kills babies and legalizes blasphemy. You think you're just... They're right up there with the Pharisees, these people. And isn't that incredible? I think the first thing we've got to worry about is if we ever think sin and evil is out there, but it's not in here. If a false prophet points the finger at everyone else, but not at himself and his own hearers. You know, if we just get together and we speak about how evil those people are, well, people are going to be very happy with that message. But real Christianity always points out the fact that we are all sinners, we need salvation, that the heart of the problem is the problem of the heart, and that we don't just see sin and evil as a problem for them out there, but it's a problem for us. All of us are sinners. And so to get to the idea that my ancestors, my parents, my grandparents, they were evil because look what they tolerated, and then to be blind, look at the evils that are outside you all around us. And it's not just out there, it's in here. That's the problem. And I just look at our present generation, the people who are deplatforming, who are stoning, burning, pulling down statues, they are the most arrogant, self-centered, spiritually blind generation imaginable. They don't see the sin in themselves. There's no humility and repentance. There's no fear of God. There's just hatred and anger against everyone. Because I'm so morally righteous and upright, but you people, you need to be deplatformed. You shouldn't be allowed to speak. You can't be allowed on a campus. This person should be kicked out. You can't have this person as a lecturer. This person shouldn't be allowed to publish this. Where does this come from? They think they're morally pure and they think everyone else is evil. They don't understand the depravity of man. They don't understand the fear of God. And that's why they're so willing to have everyone else deplatformed and silenced, censored, call it hate speech, whatever they want. They don't understand their own sinfulness. Now, the moment you do, it brings a lot of humility. We realize that I'm actually part of the problem. And that's when you get people like Martin Luther was asked, who's the worst pope you've lived under? He said, the most. The worst pope? Yes, he lived during 11 popes. Pope self. The pope who sits on the throne in my heart, which should be reserved for God. And when Charles Spurgeon was asked, which member of Baptist Tabernacle has caused the most trouble to you? And he says, Charles Spurgeon. Said, do you have a member who's called Charles Spurgeon? He said, yes, I refer to myself. You know, the 5,800 members in Metropolitan Tabernacle, said, nobody has given him more grief than he's given himself. I am my own worst enemy. That is a revelation which these liberals screaming on the campuses right now really need to learn. If they could just realize that, then they would be a bit more humble about all these people who they disagree with. Yeah, but King Leopold, the Belgians damn him to hell. He's like the most evil man in history. And they produce junk out there like King Leopold's ghost and what have you. And think. You'll be very surprised that if on the Day of Judgment, King Leopold gets a well-done, good and faithful servant and you get damned to hell. Which is probably going to happen, actually, because you know these little arrogant pro-aborts ranting and raving about King Leopold's evils because he's part of colonialism. Actually, he wasn't. It wasn't colonialism at all. It was the Congo Free State. Freeing the people, the actual goal of the Congolese running Congo. The goal wasn't for it to be part of Belgium or for the Belgians to run it or anything like that. It was just to prepare them to rule themselves. That was the goal. I mean, not everywhere in Africa was a settlement. Some places were colonies, some were protectorates. Congo, in many ways, was meant to be a protectorate. It wasn't always. Some of Stanley's successes were corrupt and mismanaged, but the intention was a protectorate. Places like Sudan were never a British colony, it was a protectorate. Lawsiland in Western Zambia was never a colony, it was a protectorate. The Lawsi king asked the British to protect them because the Portuguese might raid for them for slaves. They wanted protection. And Swaziland asked to be a British protectorate. Basutoland, what's now Lesotho, asked to be a British protectorate. Some places asked to be protectorates. They weren't colonies. They were never colonies. And so, to just paint the whole not same brush. They were all cronies. They were all abused. It was all bad. That's not intelligent. Like the friends in Sudan, they told me we were never cronies. British came and stopped the slave trade and to set us free, which is what they did. They never had freer, better rule than the 58 years that Britain ruled them, because before that the Egyptians just used them for slavery and ivory, and since then the Arabs have used them for jihad. So the golden era is the time that are condemned as the colonial era, but for many people it's the only time they had uncorrupt, efficient government and efficient services. Now that is doubtless politically incorrect and would be deplatformed on most university campuses today in the West. You can't say, I mean, imagine me giving a presentation to Henry Morton Stanley at UCT. Do you think I could get by for a few minutes without being shouted down? It's just, but how many of those people have even traveled to these countries? Now, I've been to the Congo.
What source of information have they got? Because they've probably been told something that's just not true.
Exactly.
And then how do you sort of, you know, have meditated on this lie for a while? It's kind of hard to get it out of their head.
Yes, so when you think, most people today think like they do because of the education, entertainment, and news media they've imbibed. Now, when you've got the same blasphemous antichrist pagans dominating the education, entertainment, news media, and they're all giving the same message, everything Christian's bad, evil, it's horrible. And then they, but blasphemy is totally acceptable, and all these other evils. And then what do you expect when they come out to the version of history? Oh, this is going to be really hard. Do I believe these cocaine sniffing, child abusing perverts, blasphemous pagans, or do I believe what the Bible says? And what, you know, this is a really tough call now. How can I make up them? Well, look at the source. Can we trust these people? They've lied about everything. And the same people who told you you had to wear a mask and had to get this so-called vaccine which hadn't been tested, and you had to do this, these are the same people who are telling you this, that, and the other. Well, you can't trust them in one thing. Why should you trust them in another?
Also, could they relate to... They can't relate, because it's like, oh, that's nothing, I'll just get my phone and navigate the GPS. You know, they don't actually think into the situation that none of that existed. In fact, there wasn't even a single aerial photograph of anything on the planet at that point.
Yes.
They had to see everything. I mean, that river was a maze.
Yeah.
They didn't have an aerial photo of that. So just these simple things which a lot of people...
Yeah.
Just
the average person's probably never got lost. I got lost. First time down from Rhodesia, first time up Table Mountain as a teenager, I got lost on Table Mountain. I got lost all night. I was stuck there. You see, Table Mountain's not that big. Might you, when a mist comes down, your visibility's low, you can get lost on Table Mountain. Now, that's nothing compared to Congo. Stick the guy in the middle of the Congo, talk about getting lost. Yow. And you can't compare anything in our life with what these people have to go through. None of us will have to go through anything like that. So,
yeah. They had to have on the mission. It would be, you know, boat building, refixing, repairing boats, carrying the things physically carrying them, path orienteering before they carried the boats. There's huge things that you probably, that's why 1,000 pages.
Yeah, and they had to learn to sew. Someone like Henry Morton Stanley, he had to sew up his clothes and his boots after falling apart. I mean, there wasn't a single woman on this expedition. The men had to learn to do everything, from cooking to fixing. I'm sure that they didn't do a very good job of it sometimes, but the thing is they had to do it. Just had to. For survival.
It goes from like ultra physical to very intellectual mapping out, writing out what you've done during the day, and then putting it into a coherent book.
Yes, it's enough just to travel down there, but to lead the people to fight the battle. And he chronicled, and he mapped the river, and he got the different tribes and customs and all sorts of things all the way along, so much so that he could go back and without another fight bring peace and civilization, order and commerce to the whole place. Absolutely amazing. I don't think there's a journalist on the planet who could do that today. It's just beyond staggering. And The reason why I think it's so important to look at someone like this, this isn't a normal missionary son, but he's a historic figure. What Stanley's benefit to us is he gives a snapshot of what societies were like before the gospel got there. And we need that, because right now we're having this whole cancel culture crowd trying to tell you that Christianity is the root of all evil. Everyone was living happily and wonderfully in some kind of democratic harmony, and then along came the missionaries and they wrecked everything with the gospel. You know, if you could just get rid of Christianity. And honestly, they may not say it that bluntly, but that's the implication. There's so often Christianity is a problem, but if you look at every society before the gospel got there, what it was like. You read about the Saxons before Boniface and Ulfilas brought the gospel there, and what Ireland was like before Patrick, or what Russia was like before Cyril got there, or what the Vikings were like before the gospel got to them. These people were savage, brutal, cruel, as you wouldn't want to live in any of these societies. And we've taken the blessings of Christianity so for granted that I think people need a wake-up call. This is what it was like before the gospel was here. And that's what it's going to be like if we kick the gospel out. Things will revert back to that sort of savagery in fairly short order. And it is. I mean, you can see some cities, inner cities, how they can just deteriorate so fast. If you let the gospel influence go out, what happens? But then you can have, like New York, Harlem was getting into real savagery. And in goes a missionary like David Wilkerson. He brings the gospel, cross the switchblade story, into the variant. The gospel can change everything. And if you kick the gospel out, everything can go to pieces. And it doesn't take that long. I mean, just look at what's going on in Europe and America right now. You can see as the people turn away from God, things just fall apart very fast. Yes?
Yeah, I think I was just thinking around the Christian past. What are the sources of that kind of history where God did flat for me? So I'm just imagining if it's like a spectacle or a view, a window looking from the down back to history. If you look at how it's written in history around the case of King Leopold's handling of Congo. The cases of brutality and petitions and amassing of the land and other people being within history, and looking at how things have started Stanley, that really, when he couldn't actually negotiate British intervention, his sponsoring and his movement towards Congo, he turned to Belgium, who funded the expedition, and now eventually the control of Congo by Leopold and that. So now, when people look at the results of that kind of colonialism, where there are evidence of deep brutality, right? That spread to the point where, what's his name now? The Congolese first democratic president.
I'm not sure who the new one is, but I believe they've now got a man who's meant to be a Christian as president there in the Congo at the moment. Apparently, we had someone, a missionary from the Congo, just giving us a report that they've now apparently got a Bible-believing Christian as president of the Congo, which makes a nice change, because they haven't had one for like that yet. So I don't know who this person is, but we know how evil Mobutu and...
Yeah, I'm talking about Lumumba, right? I was going to get to the point of Lumumba, right?
Yeah.
So I'm saying that I'm trying to reflect to the question you asked. It could be a reflection from the contemporary, supposedly, and I mean the 1950s and 40s and 1910, the 20th century, battle that can now begin to paint the entire process as being uncanny and the rest. Because, I mean, from what I've read, there have been cases of quite inhuman activism that Leopold funded in Belgium, which was now claimed to be Leopold's Belgium, until when Lumumba now struggled to have a determination in the 1950s and 60s. So, and now it's traced back to Stanley.
Well, the problems didn't start to Stanley. The problems started more like with Adam and Eve. But the problems before Stanley were light years worse. He certainly brought peace and extended people's life expectancies, doubled, trebled people's life expectancies in the Congo by bringing not just peace and harmony, but commerce and medicine and all kinds of modern farming methods and the ability of communications. You couldn't travel just beyond the next tribe in the past, but under him, things got to the position where you could travel across the whole country in 4 days by car. Now you couldn't travel across the Congo by car in 4 months with a four-wheel drive. You could, with a normal car, drive across in the 1950s from one side to the other in less than 4 days. And this vast country was not just civilized, but the extent of the gospel and the spread of the gospel and literacy and so many good things. So that if people want to complain about the abuses, and surely there are abuses under every government because there's petty, small-minded bureaucrats in every administration who are a curse. But you cannot compare that with the rampant slavery, cannibalism, intertribal warfares that was going on beforehand, nor with the chaos that came to Congo under Patrice Lumumba and the Simbas, and the absolute degradation that occurred in the Great Lakes Wars in the late 1990s, in which millions died. Goodness me. I don't know how I've even got internet connectivity up here. Let's close that down, shall I? So the thing is, this is my point, that it's all so easy today for us to be complaining about how people were recently and what went wrong with this and that. But look at the context. The Congo was a place where nobody had freedom of movement, freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of religion, freedom of anything, no access to decent medical care, their life expectancy was short, the chances that they could end up in a cooking pot was there. How can one complain about some maladministration under Leopold compared to what they were saved from? The goal was a Congo Free State. And while obviously one should be critical and see what could have been done better, it's like these people who complain about the missionaries ruining these ancient civilizations of the Mayans and the Aztecs and the Incas. The Mayans, the Aztecs and the Incas ripped beating hearts out of people every day. They had tens of thousands of people sacrificed every year to make the sunrise every day. They were involved in such colossal slave raids. And then to complain, I'm not pro-Catholic at all, but the Catholics were a vast improvement on the Aztecs, Incas, and the Mayans in Central and South America. And for people to complain about, the Spanish conquistadors. Yes, well, I don't think the Spanish conquistadors were very nice people either, but they stopped the human sacrifices and all these other evils, and it was a good thing, generally speaking. Now, I think it's an even better thing that people in South America are turning to the gospel away from Catholicism. But the first step was to end the brutality of the Aztec, Inca, and Mayan civilizations, which were brutal, and so on. So, I think one needs... there's problems in Russia today, but it's light years better than under Stalin and Brezhnev and Khrushchev and all those communist dictators. So I think that's why I had such shock and disgust for these Belgians who today are condemning Leopold. When they can't see, they are funding the dictators of Africa today who are brutalizing the people while they murder their own babies at home. They're blind to their own guilt and responsibilities, and they're so critical of people of whom they know actually nothing. And it's easy. I believe what the media is doing and our politicians are doing these days is they are getting us distracted from their crimes as they loot the countries by pointing to previous people. So you take Mugabe. While Mugabe was looting Zimbabwe and destroying the people of Zimbabwe, he kept pointing back and blaming Smith and the colonials and the whites and all that. And nobody in Zimbabwe was impressed after a while. They realized, wait a minute, this is just a distraction. Nobody starved in Rhodesia. Why are we starving now? Yes, we had droughts in Rhodesia, but nobody starved and all that. And so they could suddenly see Mugabe's just distracting from his nonsense. And the same thing in this government. The ANC's using the bogeyman of apartheid to justify their state capture, looting, corruption, and all the crimes that they're doing. How nice to blame someone else. I think this is the sin of mankind. It's my parents' fault. My grandparents' fault. It's a teacher's fault. You know, you blame everyone else, and that is what the false prophet does. The false prophet and the communists, they blame everything else to distract from their own crimes. Smokescreen. We need more critical research. So what I've done is I've taken primary research from Stanley's books. This is what he said, what he reported, what he saw. This is a window. This is a snapshot, a series of snapshots to see this is the way one person reported on things at this time. It's jarringly different from what we're getting from others. But it's a first-hand account from the 1800s. Now, we've got some people today who have done no research who are convinced of things of which they know absolutely nothing, except that some cocaine-sniffing drug addicts and blasphemers told them this is the way it is. So I'd always question my sources. Brian, you were going to say...
No, I wasn't.
Oh, it looked like you were...
I just think, you know, the point is, it's not only... there is a deliberate lie going about many things to achieve a certain objective and to take people in a certain direction. They're not arguing about historical fact or anything like that. They're not even interested. They want to achieve a political end with all this stuff. Form political opinion and drive the herd in a certain direction. So, and the thing with them too is it's not the end justifies the means. So you can lie, you can do anything, you can steal, whatever brings about what you think is the correct end, because they're completely amoral. You know, all things of integrity and truth and all that sort of stuff is out the window today. So, I mean, typically, you know, this election in Arizona. A complete and utter shame.
Yes.
There's no shame in it. If you can get away with it, you do it, because you've got a goal. So yeah. We're living in an age where truth and integrity and all that stuff is almost like old fashioned.
Yeah.
There isn't a shame about things.
Oh, they lie, steal, and cheat all the time.
And a mother can murder her own child, but there's no shame in it. You know, and in fact, you get furious if someone else says, no, you shouldn't be doing that. So we've reached an extraordinary point in human history.
Yes. Perversion is celebrated. I think, as somebody said, first it's tolerated. Yeah. After a while it's accepted. Then you've got to applaud it. And after a while you've got to conform to it. I mean, that's the point. You're either fighting evil or you, after a while, you find yourself accepting it. And they've done this in the church. There's a whole lot of people at church who would have been horrified at the idea of perversion a while ago, who now are, oh, well, you mustn't be judgmental. Well, you can be judgmental if the person is coming out of the conservative biblical perspective, but not for speaking up against what the Bible condemns. So, any other questions or comments? Henry Morton Stanley, one of the most incredible and controversial characters, and I don't expect everyone to like everything about him, but remember that people in history, we can learn from them all, whether we like them, disagree with them or not. And for example, someone like Oliver Cromwell. There's a lot of people I know who don't like Cromwell because he put a king on trial. And he was part of the court that condemned him to death. And there's royalists who just are horrified at Oliver Cromwell. But Oliver Cromwell did a lot of good. A lot of good that one needs to look at too. And you can like him or dislike him. I mean, Cecil John Rhodes is not in my top 100 favorite people. I don't know if he is a good man. I do know he is a great man. And there's things we can learn from his life. But personally, I don't think I would have particularly liked Cecil John Rhodes. He achieved a lot. But we can still learn from history about it. And I will study anyone in history. I mean, I've studied Stalin. I can't think of one good thing to say about him, though. But I can think of one good thing to say about Mugabe. Mugabe made a stand against the LGBT gay agenda. And we sent him a congratulation letter on that basis. So, you know, even a stopped clock is right twice a day. And for that matter, I don't particularly like Cyril Rinpoche and the ANC policies. But as far as the stand with BRICS and for Russia and against the West sanctions, Russia goes, I think they're right. And just because I oppose their party doesn't mean I can't agree with their policies on occasion. On this occasion, I think they're more right. I think the DA, who on this pro-Ukraine kick, I think they're wrong. And so on. So it should be that way, that I don't have to say, well, I've got to take my people's side all the time. There are areas where I think my father was wrong. There's areas where I think my country is wrong. There's areas where I can see they're right. And there's other times when you look at your opposing team, you think, but they're more right on this one than we are. I think as Christians, we've got that freedom to be able to recognize that I was wrong there, and he was right there. I was right here, and he was wrong there. And you go through, and we can take something from all these characters in history and say, you know, we'll take the meat, spit out the bones kind of thing. There's some good in the worst of us, and there's bad in the best of us, because we fall in creation. And so we mustn't expect perfection from anyone except God, and there's going to be a lot of failings in every human being, including ourselves, and therefore to be not so, we can't be this perfectionistic. And I think some people like that in lectures. I won't vote for this person because he's not perfect. Well, no one's perfect. But if you don't vote for this candidate, the communists might get in. I mean, can you, sometimes you've got to see there's a balance here. And in politics, you don't get perfect. You just get, you know, the least worst.